History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a few simple steps. We can ask some questions, and then if we're patient enough to listen, it's really amazing just how much we can add to our perspective and understanding. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The story we get to hear today from 103-year-old Bill Powell of Fort Collins, Colorado, is one that's sure to raise your eyebrows, maybe even more than once. Nobody has done more in northern Colorado to honor and remember veterans than my friend Brad Hoops, who introduced me to Bill and his daughter Barb, whom you're going to hear from a little later. In fact, Brad's initiative is called Remember and Honor, and if you search for that Remember and Honor on Facebook, you'll find a lot of material that if you enjoy this show, I'm pretty sure it's going to appeal to you as well. Bill Powell is going to tell us about his 10th mission as a B-24 pilot with the 461st Bomb Group, how close he came to never coming home, and what it was like to spend 7 months as a prisoner of war. But we always like to go back to the beginning, don't we? I don't expect you to take me back 103 years, but maybe close to 100. Where did you grow up, and what are some of your earliest childhood memories?
In northern Ohio, near Cleveland. Spent all my time growing up at that point.
And those were the Depression years. Do you have some memories about what life was like there in the 20s and 30s?
Well, fortunately, my father was an employee of the city, and the city managed to keep up some sort of pay. We were not the worst people that survived.
And what city was that?
Elyria, Ohio. So about 25 miles west of Cleveland.
I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember as a boy having some ideas, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do X, Y, Z, or this is who I'm going to be?
Well, since my father was a civil engineer, I had a rather close association with engineering, and so I definitely decided to go with a civil engineer, and my college education was in engineering.
So if I'm doing the math, so you were in college when America entered the war, huh?
Well, I started out at Case School of Applied Science in Cleveland, and I went a year there, then I stayed out for a year or two to do some work, and then I went to Ohio Northern University in Ada, Ohio, and I graduated from there with a degree in civil engineering.
And not to bounce around too much, but it hit me that I probably need to ask you, when you caught the aviation bug, what are your earliest memories of airplanes or the idea of flying?
Well, we weren't too far from Cleveland Airport when I grew up, so I guess we had views of various planes coming in and out, and that always tricked my imagination as to flying one of those.
Were you ever in an airplane before you entered the military?
Oh, yes. We had made a couple of flights various places.
Did you feel something that hooked you, that made you want to do that more?
Yes, I think so. I always was interested in it. And we lived not too far from Cleveland Airport, so we saw a lot of traffic going back and forth there.
So you've got the engineering background. You're studying to be an engineer. But then the war comes along. Do you have a specific memory of December 7th, 1941, and how you heard that news?
Yeah, I was in school at the time, Ohio Northern University, and we had walked out of the place where we were living and started to walk toward the university, and some of the guys said, "Hey, did you hear what happened?" And I said, "No." And so they went ahead and told us that Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor.
Had you ever heard of Pearl Harbor before?
No.
And when did you start thinking, you know, I might be involved in this war?
Well, I knew I was going to get involved because I was of that age and I was physically able. So I knew I would be somewhere in it.
And I've interviewed a few World War II vets over the years who have the unique distinction of serving while their fathers were serving. And your father was a World War I veteran who also served in World War II?
Yes, he served in World War II. He was an engineer in the vicinity of Ohio and Indiana with various service facilities that were being built there. So he spent his whole service life in Ohio and in Indiana.
It's a good way to do it. You were in a few more dangerous places, as it turned out. But that journey to becoming a pilot, I met a lot of guys who joined the Army Air Corps in World War II because they wanted to be pilots, but a lot of them ended up navigators, bombardiers, gunners. What made you believe you could rise to the top and get through all that and become a pilot?
Well, I felt that with the engineering facilities that I had, that I could probably at least get a chance to be in the Air Force someplace, and hopefully as a pilot.
Were there any moments along the way as you went from different stages of training that made you wonder if you were going to make it?
Oh, I think that was always a wonder when you come to a new station. You wonder, well, what are they going to have that I can qualify for, and what can I do? With the feeling that, I'm capable of doing whatever they want with me.
Well, I'm just guessing that before you ended up in the 461st Bomb Group, you probably got to fly a few different aircraft. What are some of the planes that you flew along the way?
Well, the PT something or other, which is a primary flight plane, and that was a single-engine biplane. Went to primary training, basic training. All the time those planes were getting bigger and bigger, and I qualified in every station for being a pilot after some test flights and so on and so forth. So I was accepted as a pilot.
Any hairy moments along the way? Rough landings or unexpected turns?
No, I don't expect anything too much. Macon, Georgia, we had some bad weather a few times. That was about it.
How did you feel about this idea of going overseas? And did you know what you were getting into?
Well, that's the ultimate anticipation, that you will be assigned overseas. Can you get in where the action is?
The crew you ended up flying with, were you guys together in the States before you went overseas?
A few of us were.
What do you remember about that journey over to Europe?
After we finished flight training, we went up to New York. We flew from New York down to the Azores and then over to our assigned place in Italy. That's when we picked up the B-24. But we had some education in flying the B-24.
Well, and to go from New York, across all that ocean, I hope you had a pretty good navigator, huh?
Well, we got there, so I guess we did.
And how many men were you responsible for? How many men on that plane?
I think we just had 10. A single flight crew was there together.
You remember your very first mission? What that was like?
We made a couple of missions over the Adriatic to some dockside facilities that had been set up by the Germans, mm-hmm. or by the Italians, anyhow. We made 3 flights, I think it was, to Le Havre, France. The Allies had landed in the Adriatic and moved on up the Rhone River and gotten as far north as just beyond Le Havre, and they had established or had captured a German airfield at that point and re-established it. And so we flew bombs and gas into that point. In other words, we just loaded up our planes as much as they could take in both bombs and gas, and delivered it to the French.
Most of us, especially today, I mean, America hasn't been flying B-24s for decades, so most of us will never know what it feels like to fly a B-24. Can you give us a taste of what it feels like to be in the cockpit and in control of that flying anvil, as some called it?
It was a good flying airplane, so there wasn't much to it except to always remember what you were doing, where you were going, and all the aspects of flying a four-engine B-24.
And I know we're going to talk a lot about your 10th and final mission, but were there any moments in your first 9 missions that got your attention, that gave you a taste of what was to come or made you a little anxious?
Well, as near as I can remember, they were unopposed, outside of maybe a little anti-aircraft at some of the stations that we bombed. That was about it.
But the 10th mission, unfortunately, didn't go that way. October 4th, 1944. I'd just love to let you explain that day and what you remember about it as best you can.
The 10th mission was a mission up to Germany at Munich to bomb the marshaling yards. And then coming back from that, I had just turned over the controls to the co-pilot, who of course was sitting right next to me, looked out the front window, and here come 2 500-pound bombs from above us. And they were American bombs. You could tell from stuff that had been loaded to us, the same thing. And the slight observation of a bomber of some type up there, probably a B-24. I was flying the right wing of the lead plane, and they hit the lead plane, both of them, with a tremendous explosion, and my co-pilot immediately slumped over, and I grabbed the controls again and started to assess the damage that we had, and I knew that we weren't going to get very far. So this was in Germany, and so on the way back, unfortunately, it had knocked out the front turret, and behind the turret was the workspace, paper-wise, for the bombardier and the navigator. We started on back, of course, and it had knocked out the outboard engine, which left us 3 engines, and then the inboard engine was also damaged. I eventually had to feather that, so we were riding on 2 engines. I thought, well, we've got to get back to southern Italy. We have to fly over the Alps on the way back. And the navigator couldn't get to his quarters because it had been bombed out along with the front turret. So what are we going to do? I don't think with 2 engines I might not make it over the Alps. And I know that there might be some ways around it, but the navigator doesn't have any maps to direct us. So I gave the order to bail out. We're just going to sacrifice the plane and bail out so that we don't get hurt any further. And I knew we were over Germany, so I just gave the order to bail out. And that's what happened. All 10 of us got out.
Even the co-pilot?
Oh, no, he was killed. A piece of shrapnel must have hit him. And I could see that he had lost somewhere from his left shoulder, complete left shoulder laid down. I suppose the arm was gone too, but I knew he was dead because he wasn't bleeding.
I know it's been more than 80 years and you've told the story a couple times, but you just described all of that really matter-of-factly. I'm thinking when you were a 20-something kid in charge of that airplane, this had to be a pretty chaotic scene. I mean, the plane in front of you blows up, shrapnel comes into your cockpit, blows up your nose, kills your co-pilot, and it sounds like if you hadn't stood up right before that, you would have been killed too, is that right?
Yeah, I have no idea what happened to him and how he got blown up like that, and I didn't suffer any damages, and nobody else on the plane suffered any damage that I knew of, so I just gave the order to bail out, and I knew that we were still over a portion of Germany, So we just had to wait and see what happened from that point.
It's time for our first break, but we'll let this 103-year-old tell us what happened when we come back. Find some photos related to Bill Powell and his story at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 103-year-old Bill Powell of Fort Collins, Colorado, originally from Elyria, Ohio. When we left off, he was telling us about October 4th, 1944, when his 10th mission as a B-24 pilot with the 461st Bomb Group was interrupted by a tragic mishap. The lead plane in his formation was hit with two 500-pound bombs from above, dropped by another American bomber. The resulting explosion sent shrapnel through the nose of Bill's B-24, instantly killing his co-pilot. Bill had gotten up to stretch his legs just before that. I'm sure you've thought about it a time or two over the years. What's your real opinion? What do you think would have happened to you if you were still strapped in that left seat?
Nothing happened to me, fortunately. As far as shots were concerned and bombing was concerned, nothing happened to me, so I was able to get out as long as I could get my crew out. Just a freak accident anyhow, so we hadn't been subject to any anti-aircraft or any fighter. Of course, the German fighter facilities at that time were all concentrated on action from the invasion of France to the west.
So before that day, before that moment, had you ever thought about the possibility of becoming a prisoner of war?
No.
But you're bailing out of this airplane. You know you're behind enemy lines. What was that journey down to the ground like in that parachute?
That was it. Trying to think, well, what's going to happen now? When I hit the ground, if nobody's around, am I going to try to walk out of France? Or what's going to happen to me? So I wondered all the way down. And when I hit the ground, I turned around and got my parachute bundled up, and there stood a farmer with a gun on me. He doesn't speak English, and the only German words I could think of were the word for friend. I knew then that, of course, that he wasn't going to accept that. So he motioned for me to bundle up my parachute and then come ahead of me, and we walked up to a small village close by. He motioned me to go in the front door there, which I did. I walked into a room, the family room of this particular house, and there were likewise houses on either side of the street, just a small house, not big ones. And he motioned me to go in this one house, which I did. And when I walked in, here was the living room with enough seats on either side to be able to seat probably 10 women on it as a total. And when I walked in, I put the parachute down, and they immediately jumped on it. they wanted that material that the parachute was made out of.
They wanted to make some dresses, huh?
Yeah, it was my first experience with the Germans.
And to this point, you don't know what happened to the rest of your crew or where they came down or what they were up to?
No, as far as I knew, everybody got out, because I checked what I could see of the rest of the plane, which was all of it, and everybody was down. The tail gunner came out last. Everybody else had gone except me. And the tail gunner walked out, and I said, get down there. So he bailed out. And then when I first walked out of the cockpit with my chute, the radio man was standing there. Fortunately, we hadn't closed our bomb bay doors, so there was plenty of room to get out. He was standing there in front of the front bomb bay, right in front of me, and so he started to go, and then he stepped back. So I hit him and knocked him out. And to the best of my knowledge, he made it all right.
So you're in this family's home. How did they treat you?
Everybody was so interested in that parachute that they didn't pay any attention to me. And the German guard I had then made a motion toward the door or something, and a ranking German soldier came in. Well, he spoke English, I think, and he said, come this way. So I went with him. And right close to where this village was, I guess it was on the outskirts of the village, there was a German outpost, just an office-like thing. Mm-hmm. He took me in there, and I introduced myself to two other American pilots who were sitting there. One of them was a fighter pilot who had gotten shot down, and the other one was a B-25 bomber that had gotten shot down somewhere. But he had gotten shot down for making his second run of the day, a follow-up run. So he got shot down. Well, so there was three of us, and of course the German officers in there spoke English and said, we're taking you up to Frankfurt.
The infamous interrogation center?
Yeah, they said, there's an interrogation center there, which you we'll have to go through. They must have put us on a train right away. We hadn't had anything to eat. None of the three of us had had. So we started to complain about being hungry. So the train stopped and dropped us off, us three guys and a German guard. First thing they told us, they said, if you promise not to try to escape, we will leave you with your shoes and belts. And, of course, we promised that because we didn't know where we were, where we were going. So the train stopped, I guess, and dropped us off at some village on the way. So we managed to get a lunch. But the people that were already in there, this was a public restaurant in there, they scowled and stomped and probably cussed us out. Which we couldn't understand, but we understood that they had reason to. So when we finished that, we went out and got aboard another train and continued it on up to Frankfurt. They took us in there, provided us with some so-called living quarters. In other words, there was a room there with a bed and toilet facilities. We stayed in there probably overnight. The next day they called us in for questioning. I hadn't been in the unit very long, so I didn't know too much about squadron activities and so on and so forth. So I just told them I didn't know, I hadn't been there. And they kind of accepted that, told us to stand by. So I just sat back and waited till, I think it was the next day, it might have been 2 days, at least a day. Then they called a number of us out. It was surprising to me how many prisoners they had. And they put us aboard a train headed for Stalag Luft 1, which was on Barth on the Baltic. And I assume that in normal times, it was probably a summer vacation spot for the Germans, because it's right on the Baltic.
But I know this wasn't going to be a vacation for you. And I've got to ask you, I've had a lot of people tell me with these German interrogators that not only did they often speak perfect English, but a lot of times they knew things about some of those captured airmen that they didn't even know about themselves. Did they have a file on you? Did they tell you anything that they knew about you?
Yes, I assume that they knew about me anyhow, because after they interrogated me and I hadn't been there long enough to know very much about the squadron anyhow, we talked a little bit afterward, and I discovered that they knew more about the squadron than I did.
And what were the accommodations like at Stalag Luft 1?
They sent me down to their prison section and put me in barracks number 10, as near as I can remember. And that's what the prison camp was made up of, a series of buildings that were opened up inside just for prisoners. They had double bank cots in there to sleep on. I think I was the last one to be housed in that particular room in that barracks.
And I'm sure you had a nice cushy bed and plenty of comfortable blankets and a heater in the corner.
Well, we had straw mattresses. That was a mattress in the bunk. And they were double bunks. It was heated. The whole building was heated, in particular that room. You know, if you slept with your clothes on, it wasn't too bad.
Even in the worst winter that Europe had seen forever? Because, I mean, this is, you're not too far before the Battle of the Bulge was beginning. We've heard all those infamous stories. Did it get pretty cold that winter?
I don't recall that we suffered any particular disadvantage from it. Being so fully closed 24 hours a day was probably all right.
How about the food?
The food was occasional. No, I don't mean occasionally in an amount. There was enough amount, but it was hard to tell sometimes exactly what it was. But then the German people were suffering the same thing. We occasionally got Red Cross parcels. When we got Red Cross parcels, we would combine all of those in the room, because by that time we didn't go to the mess hall. In fact, as I think the mess hall had been burned down, we would combine those parcels. Although we didn't get all of our parcels every day, but there was enough that we could combine it and all and get a meal or two out of that.
I've had a lot of ex-prisoners of war who were held in Germany talk about the bread that the Germans would give you that had a pretty healthy sawdust content, apparently.
It was hard to cut. I don't recall that we experienced any sawdust in it. We may have.
Well, maybe this is a way to put it in perspective. So October 4th, 1944 was your 10th and final mission when you got shot down. How much do you think you weighed approximately then?
Oh, probably 150, somewhere around 155, something around in there.
And when you finally got liberated roughly 7 months later, what'd you weigh then?
I have no idea. I'm sure we got weighed, but I don't recall what it was.
But you probably lost a few pounds.
I'm sure we did.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm trying to hear from you. What was the hardest part, the most challenging part of being a prisoner?
Just waiting. Waiting to be liberated without suffering any particular exposition. Well, the guys that were there before me had elected certain officer or something of that nature to be heading up that section of the prison. And one of them, I can't remember his name now, was an American fighter pilot ace. Mm-hmm. He was a well-known ace, so that they had that. But he was in prison camp with us, not in our particular barracks, but he was there.
You said the waiting was the hardest part. Every time I've tried to put myself in a POW's shoes, that uncertainty, seems like it could be overwhelming, not just waiting, but isn't there part of you that wonders, will I ever get out of here? Will I ever make it back to see my family again?
Well, I'm sure that it occurred to all of us, although we all had the confidence that we were going to excel in the overhead in the beginning.
And did your family know that you were there? Were you able to communicate with them?
Well, they were notified that I was a German prisoner. Eventually, I was able to inform them by mail, and I also got mail from them.
I bet being in prison camp and getting a letter from home is a pretty good feeling.
Oh, it definitely is. And for the guys that didn't happen to, well, you had to just buck them up a little bit.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, the idea of bucking up a fellow prisoner, because I'm just guessing there were days where sometimes your hope starts to dwindle a little bit.
No, the war was at a point where I think we had full confidence that we were going to overcome it at some point in the hopefully near future.
I've heard some pretty good stories from prisoners, especially even at your camp, Starlog Luft 1, about finding a way to smuggle in a little contraband or get creative in taking certain supplies and making things out of them, whether it was a crystal set radio they'd hide under the floorboards, or one ex-POW from your camp showed me the ring that he made, and the metal was from the bully beef cans in your Red Cross parcels, and the setting was from his toothbrush. Do you have any memories of things you did to pass the time or ingenuity that cropped up here and there?
I think we spent most of our time playing bridge.
How did the Germans treat you?
We didn't have any contact with them except that the guards would come in every day, and we had to stand up about 9 o'clock in the morning. We had to be there at 9 o'clock in the morning and stand up and be counted. And the rest of the time was particularly ours. When the weather was nice enough, the grounds were big enough so we could play softball out there.
Were you a pretty good hitter?
No. I had played softball in the States, and I never was a very good hitter. I was a pitcher.
Well, and the reason that they would get you up every morning and count you is they want to make sure nobody's escaping. Did you ever contemplate that possibility?
No, because we already had stories internally of people that had tried to escape. And there were stories about two or three of them, I think, that had gotten over to the next German town. Of course, Sweden wasn't involved in the war, and so they could get aboard a Sweden boat sometimes and get back to Sweden and be recovered that way. But in my group, there was never anybody who tried to escape, or nobody that we knew of that had attempted an escape earlier.
And did any other of the members of your crew end up in your camp?
I think they did, but I never knew it. We never got together or anything because we were divided in different sections, and we didn't have the opportunity to get around. Although I think one of my crew had investigated around and found out that I was there, and he came over and talked to me for a little bit about his experiences and my experience.
You know, again, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm thinking 7 months after day after day could feel like a long time. What was it that kept you going or gave you hope that you would get out of there someday?
Well, we all had good confidence that we were going to get out of there, of course. Even at that point, we could assume that the Allied armies were going to oversee the Germans.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, what was it like to taste freedom again after 7 months in captivity? Don't you want to be like Bill Powell when you're 103? I know I do. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. What a remarkable conversation with 103-year-old Bill Powell of Fort Collins, Colorado, a bomber pilot who had to bail out on his 10th mission as a result of a friendly fire incident. He landed behind enemy lines and spent the next 7 months as a prisoner. By late April 1945, the combat lines were drawing pretty close to where he was held, Stalag Luft 1 in Barth, Germany. Was there a buildup to your liberation where you started to hear rumblings of what was happening?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because some of our officers who were our keepers also would get radio communications from the Germans as to what was going on. So they knew what the situation was all through. And then, of course, we knew that the Russians were coming someplace.
That's a story I have read about a little bit and had some veterans, some ex-POWs tell me, and you referenced an ace earlier. I think if my memory is correct, that was a guy named Zemke who then dealt with the leadership of the camp and made sure that you guys didn't get handed over to the Russians. Is that what you remember?
Well, I remember the name Zemke. All of a sudden, everything cleared out, and we found out that the Russians had come over and said, "What the hell were you guys still doing in the camp? Why haven't you liberated yourselves?" But it was too early in the war then. By the time the Russians got there, we didn't have an opportunity to do anything.
Well, tell me about the day that you got to become a free man again and what that felt like.
Well, of course, they took us over to Camp Lucky Strike in France. Then we knew we were free and eventually we'd get to be home. But because there was a shortage of seaborne traffickers, we just had to wait until space became available, because they were liberating all those German camps up there, and that's where the guys were going, and eventually going home. So we took advantage of it, two or three of us. We got to visit Paris twice. I decided to use a kind of a trick question. I'd like to get over to England and see my Irish relatives, which I did have Irish relatives. So four of us got together and applied for passage to London, which they gave us in order to get rid of us. So we went over and spent a couple of days in London and a couple of days visiting the outskirts of London, and that was great. And finally they realized what they had to do to get us back, and that was cut off our money.
Party's over, huh?
Right, party's over. So we reported back, the four of us reported back to Southampton, and within a few days, we had a passage home.
What did it mean to you to come back on American soil after everything you've been through?
It was great to come back home. We ported somewhere in Jersey. We were supposed to go into New York, but that was filled up or something. We couldn't get in there, so we got liberated in New Jersey and managed to get train traffic or any other thing that we could. And I was fortunate in my hometown was a New York City main line. So I got aboard the train and came in and got out, sat down at the station and waited for my dad to come and pick me up.
I bet you can still remember the look on his face when he saw you.
Well, he was real happy, and I was happy to see him, because he had been in service too, of course, and finally got discharged.
And any time I hear a story like yours, I just have to wonder, you've lived a lot of life since World War II. 80 years since World War II. Did your experience as a POW change the perspective that you brought to the rest of your life since then?
No, I don't think so, except that I had a partial degree in civil engineering, so I hoped, of course, that when I got back, I would be involved in some sort of civil engineering function.
And that's the career you ended up in?
That's correct.
In fact, somebody told me there's a bridge named after you in Florida.
Yeah, that county commission. I was working for the county commission in Miami-Dade County. Back in earlier days, the county had built a causeway from downtown city Miami over to Key Biscayne, which was a large island off the coast and becoming more and more popular every day, particularly after the causeway was down there. They could get simple access, which didn't require a boat. The problem was the causeway had to cross the intercoastal waterway, and any traffic on the intercoastal waterway has the right-of-way. And so if there was traffic on the causeway, they had to stop because there was no bridge or any sort there. Wait for the bridge to open up so the boat traffic could get through. Then that became more of a problem because it held up emergency vehicles, for one thing, if they were coming across the causeway and had to stop for a boat. So after I got out of service, I went to work for Dade County, which I had worked for before. I took over the engineering section. We said, well, the simplest way to do that is to heighten the bridge. The causeway was promoting enough traffic anyhow to provide for widening the causeway at certain points. So we developed a high-level bridge going from the mainland in downtown Miami over to land on the causeway, well beyond the boat traffic that had to go through there. And a high-level bridge, anybody could get, any boat traffic could get through there. In fact, as I had one businessman who I had known before from downtown Miami, and he called me, he said, Bill, how high is that clearance going to be? And I said, well, I don't know. I'll check with the designers. So we had an engineering company designing that portion of the bridge and causeway. They said, oh, it'll be 11 feet. Well, it could be a little more if necessary. So I called the guy back and I told him, well, it's going to be 11 feet. He had a sailboat in downtown Miami Marina that he used to go out every now and then, and he needed 11 feet, 6 inches in clearance. So I called the designers back and told them, and they said, oh, it's no problem. We'll just add 6 inches. Oh, God.
So if I or anybody listening to this goes down there, they get to go over the Bill Powell Bridge.
That's what it says. Uh-huh. And it came as a complete surprise because, of course, by that time I was back working for Dade County. I always attended county commission meetings, particularly if I had something of consequence that was appearing before them. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden this came up about naming a bridge, Bill Powell Bridge. Well, I thought it was a bridge that had been a bascule bridge that had been across the Miami River just about four blocks from where I lived. And it was a bascule bridge because the theory was that they were going to bring some kind of boats up the Miami River to Hialeah, where I lived, unload them and do everything they had to there. So when they named the Bill Powell Bridge, across that portion of the bridge, I mean, I was flabbergasted. I had never heard of anything like that. But they went ahead and did that, and so the other bridge was named for me.
Not too many people can say that, and not too many people can say they're 103 years old. One thought, anytime I talk to someone who's been a prisoner of war, I just have to ask what your perspective on freedom is, because you've had to live in the absence of freedom. What does that mean about how you view the freedom that so many of us take for granted?
I think we all had to recognize one of these days we're going to be free. We're not going to be no prison people all of our lives. We're going to be free somehow, particularly in our situation, because we knew that the war was going to end sometime and we'd be home.
And I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and telling us a story that nobody else could tell us. If you look back on 103 years and counting, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I think it's that bridge.
That's pretty cool. What's your secret? Because people can hear you haven't been hesitating to answer questions. Your memory's clear, you're articulate and sharp, and you're 103 years old. So you must have something that you're doing right. What's your secret?
Just keep living.
And is there anything that you haven't done yet in 103 years that you still have on a list somewhere that you'd like to check off?
I think from time to time there must be something that comes up that I wish that I had been part of, but I don't think of it that often.
And have you been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington?
No, I haven't.
Because they'd love to take you on one of those honor flights.
No.
I didn't ask you this earlier. I try to remember to ask every World War II veteran that I meet. Because if you did go to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., you'd see a wall of gold stars. And it's representing over 406,000 Americans who didn't come home from the war. And I don't have to ask you if you knew any of those guys, because one of them was your co-pilot. You already told me that. How should we remember those men, over 400,000 Americans who gave their lives in World War II?
Well, yeah, I think you have to have somebody or some organization looking at those people and making sure that they're getting the proper attention in their lives.
Your co-pilot was named Lawton Jones. What did you guys call him?
Jonesy, yeah. And he was killed. And then when the war ended, we were supposed to go to Miami Beach to get discharged. I was living in Ohio, and so we decided to drive down there. My aunt and uncle, so we knew we were going to get a chance to see them. My mother was the sister of my uncle down there, and so this was an opportunity for her to go down and see them, because we'd drive down. By that time, I was married. So I had her and a brother, so we were going to use that opportunity to go down. But Lawton Jones' father and mother had moved from the interior of Georgia over to a town on the coast, and I knew that I could get an opportunity to see them. So I made arrangements ahead of time that we would stop there and see the Joneses. And then I was able to take his father out for lunch and explain what had happened to Lawton and so on and so forth. So that was an excellent opportunity.
I imagine that wasn't easy, though, to have to look his father in the eye and tell him what had happened to his heroic son.
Well, it could have happened to me, since I was sitting right next to him. But I just felt that it was an opportune situation, be able to tell him what happened, exactly what happened. And he was naturally happy to get that information.
Yeah, so many Gold Star families never have that opportunity to hear from someone who was there or know what really happened. So decades later, they actually found the wreckage and found his remains?
That's my understanding.
Well, and I feel like I just have to ask you if there's anything else you'd like to say about Lawton Jones, for those of us who never got the chance to meet him. Who did you know him to be?
Well, I knew him as a very good friend, and he was a very good co-pilot. I was certainly glad to have him aboard in my crew. I really knew him for only a short period of time.
And you said something a moment ago that caught my ear, that when you were explaining to his father what had happened, you were aware that could have been you. What do you do with a thought like that, that you realize you easily could have been killed in action or died in captivity or not made it home?
In the situation we were in, it could have happened to any of us at any time during the war. You know, we had chest chutes that were circular like this and snapped on to a harness on a chest, and we all wore that harness, so we just get the chute and snap it on. And so I carried mine behind my pilot seat, and when I got ready to bail out, there was no big hurry. The plane was still flying. I reached back to pick up my parachute, and there lay my headrest. It had been shot off.
So if the headrest was shot off and your head had been resting on the headrest, what does that say about what would have happened to your head?
Well, probably our heads never touched the headrest. It was just there for if we had to lean back or something like that. But I never recalled actually using the headrest.
But it was at the same elevation as your head.
Yeah.
So if you hadn't gotten up, you wouldn't be here.
Well, no.
You know, most people alive today didn't live through World War II. They don't really know what it was like. What do you think is important for us to know and understand all these years later?
Well, I think it's important for us to understand what war consists of and go ahead and be ready to help ourselves for whatever may come up. Even if it means another war, we have to be able to defend ourselves properly.
Perspective from a 103-year-old ex-prisoner of war. Not too often we get the privilege of hearing that, but Bill's daughter Barb gets to hear it every day.
Well, I just think that my dad is an amazing person. Very blessed to have him for 103 years. He raised two pretty great kiddos, and he's always been a very mellow person, only lost his, you know, cool a couple of times and stuff like that. But he has raised the family to have integrity, perseverance, love this country, and do whatever it is that you can for your fellow man.
Well, that is the XPOW motto. We help those who can't help themselves. Have you ever imagined yourself in a prison camp like he was for 7 months?
Oh, God, no. I wouldn't last. No, and he doesn't remember everything, but just reading the letters and things, because he has a lot of them. Yeah, how those guys managed it, you know, it was with humor. There was a lot of humor and playing games and then creating different things. So they were using their minds while they were in there. And I think that's probably what kept them going, is that they just didn't let the whole situation overwhelm them.
When you hear him tell the story of October 4th, 1944, and what happened in the cockpit of that B-24, what jumps out at you? What just still blows your mind?
That I'm actually here, because if things had been just a millimeter off, I wouldn't be here, my brother wouldn't be here, and all the grandkids and great-grands wouldn't be here. So we feel very, very fortunate that he made it through there.
That's a pretty sobering thought, isn't it?
It is very sobering, yes. So, like he has shown us, you know, we've tried to live our lives by giving back, too, because it's a blessing that we're here.
You can find a photo of Barb and that father she adores on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, along with other photos related to 103-year-old ex-prisoner of war Bill Powell and his story. That's all the time we have today, but thank you so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.